Center for Justice, his new book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America. Next up, poverty is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. We'll speak with Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, find out why he just led a march from the Supreme Court. Stay with us.
In early takes, the ones not ever heard. We keep the bleeding road, a sound that we know for sure. Each passing street light, sunrise and sunset. The endless reachable, the closer we
Car by Nowhere. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Democratic Congress members Pramila Jayapal and Barbara Lee have introduced a resolution called the Third Reconstruction to End Poverty in the United States by Addressing Systemic Racism, Economic and Public Health Inequity, Militarism, and Other Issues. It was drafted with input from the Poor People's Campaign, which just led a three-day Poor People's Campaign Moral Poverty Action Congress in Washington, D.C. This comes as child poverty is on the rise after the expanded child tax credit was allowed to expire, and hundreds of thousands are being kicked off Medicaid. A recent medical paper found poverty is the fourth leading cause of death now in the United States. For more, we're joined by Bishop Dr. William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, president of Repairers of the Breach, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about why the Poor People's Campaign held a mock funeral, starting with the Supreme Court and going to the U.S. Capitol? You've talked about poverty being a death sentence and how what was enacted during COVID that amazingly, in some cases, saved lives now has been taken away and more people are dying.
We did it, Amy, because of how grotesque and immoral it is that poverty is the fourth leading cause of death. And that's a conservative figure, because the researchers didn't even deal with children 15 years and younger. I mean, just say that. Poverty, fourth leading cause of death, higher than homicide, higher than respiratory diseases. We have the highest child poverty rate of any country like us in terms of economic power. And it's time we have to intensify what we're doing. And so at the Moral Poverty Action Congress last week, sponsored by Repairers of the Breach in the Kairos Center, hundreds of poor and low-wealth people, over 1,000, and faith leaders and economists and public health people came together to form a 30-state strategy to intensify, to force our nation's leaders to confront the American death sentence of poverty, which is totally unnecessary. And this is before COVID. Poverty was the fourth leading cause of death before COVID. During COVID, 330,000 people died from the lack of healthcare, not from COVID. Poor people died at a rate 3 to 5 times higher during COVID, the high rates, high times of COVID, not from COVID, but from the lack of access to the things that would have prevented their death. And the question we have to ask is, why do we hear so much about crime rates and opioids and gun violence in America, but poverty kills more people than all of those things? Crime rates, opioids, homicide, gun violence. Why is there no Surgeon General's warning on low-wage jobs as a form of death? So we joined with Representative Lee and Jayapal to introduce the third Reconstruction resolution ending poverty and low wealth, saying here are 20 policies. And does the Congress have the resolve, not a Democratic resolve or a Republican resolve, but a human resolve, a moral resolve to eradicate poverty and other systems of injustice, which can be done? This death is unnecessary. It is policy. Yeah, it's policy murder. And we met also with over 400 congresspersons, with Schumer. Jeffries tried to meet with McConnell and McCarthy. They wouldn't meet with us. In fact, they refused to allow us even to meet on the steps of the Capitol. But we kept going because living wages could stop death. Health care could stop death. Child poverty tax credits could stop death. Redirecting the war economy could stop death. Voting rights could stop death because it allow people, if you stop voter suppression, you undermine people getting elected who then will fight against the poor and call more death. And so we're intensifying in this coming year, 2024, we're planning 30 major actions, nonviolent at state capitals. We're planning on June 15th of next year, a massive poor people's low wage workers and moral march on Washington, D.C., and to the polls, because we're going to be mobilizing the 87 million poor and low wealth people in this country. Poor and low wealth people now make up over 30% of the electorate generally and over 40% of the electorate in battleground states. And in most places, poor and low wealth people are not voting because they feel like the system has just abandoned them. So we're saying vote and change the system, and that's what we have to do. Otherwise, we become accessories to the crime of policy murder, and that's what's going on right now.
Well, Reverend Barber, you mentioned low-wage labor as a health threat, and the minimum wage in this country has not been raised of the federal minimum wage in 14 years. And we hear all this talk about inflation in the country and how Americans are grappling with inflation, but yet millions and millions of Americans are still working in these, as you say, in these low-wage jobs, and Congress refuses to act on the minimum wage. What will it take to affect this simple approach to raising the poverty? Raising or eliminating the number of people who are in poverty.
That's right. Well, one of the things we talk about is when we go among poor, low-wealth people, whether in Appalachia or the Delta of Mississippi or Alabama or New York or California, is listen, you have power now. In most states, if just 20% of poor and low-wage workers would mobilize and vote an agenda for themselves, they could determine who sits in the presidency, in the governorship, and in the Senate, and even in the House races, both in the state and the federal. In North Carolina, for instance, it's only 19% that need to mobilize. In Florida, it's 4%. Georgia, 7%. Michigan, is 1%. But the other thing is we're saying to people, listen, during COVID, we low-wage workers saved us. We made them go to work. We called them essential workers, but treated them like they were expendable. We said, go to work in the most dangerous jobs, but you don't have living wage. Go to work, but you won't have health care. Go to work, but you don't have paid family leave. This is social murder, policy murder. It is wrong. And it's not no longer just benign. It's not just the economics of it. It's the health of it. It's, as I said, we should have a Surgeon General's warning on low-wage jobs. We also know that we haven't raised in 14 years. So if we just raise the minimum wage to $17 an hour, which is lower than actually what a living wage ought to be, but $17 an hour, some 50 million Americans would come up out of poverty and low wages. Over 40% of African Americans would come up out of poverty and low wage. Millions of white people who, and actually poor white people, make up the largest number of poor and low wage workers in this country. And most poor and low wage, poor people are the working poor. So it's backwards. And then to suggest, as some faulty economists say, that keeping wages low is the way to address inflation is just wrong. The fact of the matter is inflation has been caused by war and by COVID and by this pandemic. And if people had more money, they could survive through. So that's one of the reasons I led a delegation to meet with the president, with faith leaders and impacted people. Met at the White House. We're calling for a meeting directly with the president, with economists, faith leaders, and impacted people. We're calling on the president to do a major bully pulpit speech saying we cannot, as America, go around this world and challenge other nations, and poverty is the fourth leading cause of death, and that's a conservative figure, in the wealthiest nation in the world. We must call ourselves to conscience. And what we're going to do is make that call have to happen. We're not backing up. We're intensifying, because really it is about people's lives. And the people that we took into the White House with them, all of them had either experienced death in their families or death in their community from poverty. Want folk to hear that, from poverty, not from homicide, from poverty, not from respiratory disease, from poverty, not from diabetes, but from the effects of poverty. And that is just immoral and wrong, and we have to change it.
Bishop Barber, as we begin to wrap up, on another topic I wanted to ask about your decision to retire from church service. You gave your final sermon at Greenleaf Christian Church in Goldsboro, North Carolina, recently. You spoke about the testimony of the cripple. Explain.
Well, I talked about that because the majority of the people in the Bible whom God used had some crippling reality, mentally, physically, or otherwise, economically, and yet God used them to be transformative. There's a great scripture in the Bible that says the stones that the builders rejected have become the chief cornerstone. And so I've retired from pastoral ministry, but not from ministry. I'm going to pastor the movement of the Poor People's Campaign, Repairs of the Breach, in this new center at Yale, and try to raise up more and more people who see themselves as important instruments of fundamental change. And we have so much work to do. You know, I just watched this case out of North Carolina. That case actually is a reaction to the work we did in Moral Monday. When we won, we beat extremists on voter suppression. We beat them on redistricting.
You're talking about the independent state legislature theory being obliterated by the Supreme Court.
Exactly. And the reason I raise it is because in 1868, it was two ministers who helped lead the writing of the North Carolina Constitution after slavery that put in the Constitution the very things we now use today to fight extremists at the state level. And it's important the nation knows the reason they were trying to get that passed and get the Supreme Court to agree with independent legislatures is because we've been winning using the state constitution, and we're winning because of the efforts of people of faith long ago who fought for equality in our constitution. That's what work that I want to continue. I've been pastoring over 30 some plus years. Now it's time for me to train other ministers who are coming up and to engage as an elder and pastor the movement. And I'm humbled by the reality that I have the opportunity to do that.
Well, Bishop Dr. William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, and now founder of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. We want to thank you so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we go to Honduras, where residents are fighting private charter cities established by U.S. corporations. These are cities run by U.S. companies. Stay with us.
Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun, I say. It's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
Here Comes the Sun, sung by Nina Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to Honduras, where communities are fighting back against privatization and foreign exploitation. The Honduran president, Xiomara Castro, and the UN Congress repealed a law enacted by the previous right-wing administration that established what are known as economic development and employment zones, or CEDES. The law also allowed the private cities and special economic zones to have functional and administrative autonomy from the national government, which opponents say is a threat to Honduran sovereignty and the livelihood of local communities. Now, a Delaware-based corporation called Prospera has launched a case to challenge the repeal of the law under the Dominican Republic Central America Free Trade Agreement. The company established one of the zones on the island of Roatan and is now seeking almost $11 billion, which amounts to nearly two-thirds of Honduras's entire 2022 budget. Last month, Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren and 32 others in the U.S. Congress released a letter calling on the Biden administration to intervene, writing, quote, large corporations have weaponized and continue to weaponize this faulty and undemocratic dispute settlement regime to benefit their own interests at the expense of workers, consumers and small businesses globally. For more, we're going to Brussels, Belgium, to speak with Melinda St. Louis, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. And in Honduras, we're joined by Vanessa Cardenas, the leader of the Community Council of Crawfish Rock, the area directly impacted by the Prospera Zede on the island of Roatan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to begin in Honduras with Vanessa. Can you explain what's taking place for people to understand around the world? You've got U.S. corporations running cities? Vanessa? I think she's not hearing us, so we're going to go to Melinda St. Louis. If you can explain what's happening in Honduras.
Well, yes, it's great to be here. Thank you so much, and I really look forward to hearing from Vanessa. It is absolutely outrageous that in Honduras, after the coup in 2009, there was this radical project to create these ZEDES, as you mentioned, private cities that U.S. corporations could come in and control the territory. The territory was removed from municipal jurisdictions, and then they had then the power as a corporation to set their own regulatory standards, tax policy, monetary policy, security forces, have their own separate court system, and basically run their own government. And in the case of Roatan, this company, Prospera, came in and established this private zone where the governance structure does not allow for representative democracy from the people of the community. And at first, the people in the community didn't even know that this was happening. It's happening in such an opaque format. And once people understood what this meant in terms of taking away Honduran sovereignty and taking away land from communities, there was massive uprising, indigenous people, community organizations, even the largest business association in Honduras opposed this corrupt law. And so through the democratic process, fortunately, they managed to overturn this corrupt law. The Xiomara Castro administration ran on a platform of repealing this law, and they did so. They made good on their promise. The National Assembly overturned or repealed the law, and that really should be the end of the story. It's a victory for democracy in Honduras after a very dark period of right-wing rule. And then That's not the end of the story because of the trade agreement that no one knew about and, you know, kind of these secretive trade rules that empower corporations to be able to challenge democratic policies outside of the court system. This isn't in a U.S. court. It's not in a Honduran court. It's in a private tribunal of private sector lawyers, three arbitrators who will decide whether to basically ransack the treasury of the tiny country of Honduras to the tune of $11 billion with a B, which again, as you mentioned, would bankrupt the country. So the company is using this as an additional tool to try to bully the government to not implement the democratic will of the people. And so it's very complicated, but it's actually very simple. It's once again kind of this neo-colonial project of, you know, of U.S. companies going to the region, but in this very radical way.
Yeah, I think we have Vanessa Cardenas in Honduras now, and I wanted to go to her. Vanessa, when I was in Honduras as a reporter back 30 years ago, there were already very large export processing zones, basically to manufacture goods and send them to the United States. But this is a whole other stage here of whole cities. Could you talk about how your community, Crawfish Rock, found out about this? And what the previous government had done to keep the basic information from the people?
Yes. Hello. Well, we didn't hear it from the government, of course. We heard it through a community leader, and she practically was telling us underneath because she was so scared. But she had to, she wanted to the community to know. I actually get it from a colleague of mine, and she sent it through a WhatsApp messages. And we were, you know, we had to do so much study. We had to knock on so many doors because everyone that we asked was like, no one knew about it. The authorities knew nothing about it. So first of all, we need to know that this city, and especially City Prospera, is not like the rest of the autonomous or independent zone. This is a state within a state, which will have its own judicial system. It is run by a technical secretary chosen by the camp, and the camp itself is in the shadow. No one knows who the members of the camps are. And of course, the link that it has to the NARC state of Juan Orlando is very concerning to us. And their lack of transparency, they have not been transparent in anything they have done. This community is a small community. It's an ethnic community. And we, of course, has the rights to be free and previously consulted on any type of project that is being done in our community, if we have not been. So, you know, we have totally the trust of Prospera City, and the power that the treaties and the law gives them has us so much concern. We are so very concerned about that.
You know, I was looking at the ads to attract businesses, and it talked about these cities. It said around the world, there's something like 5,000 of these zones, but 500 of them, 10%, are in Latin America. Here in if you can talk about your community, how it's impacted, and the fact that this was imposed by the previous president, Joe, as he's called, J-O-H, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was extradited to the United States for drug trafficking, for corruption, even though it was repealed. How it's being enforced right now in your community and the particular effects on your community?
City Prospera has had a very negative impact on our community. It has had a psychological impact as well as physical impact. Why I would say psychological? Because the mental stress that we are under, we don't know when our home will be taken from us. And we have old people, we have single mothers, we have widows, and, you know, it's a problem to be stressing and worried all the time when we will have to leave our community. And physically, because the community was stuck in a limbo. No one wanted to do anything with it. There was no developing. After the law was abolished in last year, you would anyone that is from here can see that there have been numerous construction. Many homes have been, people have started to build home to fix. First, before that, because of the civic problem that we have and we still have, you know, people didn't even want to fix their fences because it was like, you know, we don't know when we have to move. And it was a constant stress as well as the environmental destruction that is being done in our community. We have torn down a complete hill, a hill that has so many species of animals, species of trees, as well as our main source of water. We already have a well that has been dried up. So it's so many things that have impacted us negative that they promise jobs and they're, it's very little jobs that that we can apply to or the people them have gotten, that the pros and the cons is more, you know, negative than positive.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Melinda St. Louis, who is this firm, Prospera, that this Delaware firm, who runs it? And also, given the fact that these many companies previously had the right to manufacture in many of these countries, what's different in terms of what these private cities offer to foreigners? Is this another haven for a crypto utopia for tech millionaires?
Yes, well, I think it really remains to be seen because it's quite a shadowy operation. You know, Prospera, as you mentioned, it is a Delaware-based company. It was created as for the ZEDE, to create this ZEDE in Honduras. And as far as we can tell, there is not a goal to do manufacturing, to really have major jobs. It can look like, on the surface, a tourist community, like a residential community. But what it looks like is really more of a political project. I mean, there was certainly there are a number of members of the Prospera community who are very active in the cryptocurrency movement. They have made Bitcoin legal tender. They have created an opportunity to become an e-resident. So you don't have to live there, but if you pay a fee, you can be an e-resident, and then you can open up a business using the very lax regulatory framework, where you can propose your own regulatory code and basically operate outside of the jurisdiction of the United States or Honduras. And so they, you know, I think that is really more what the project is of Prospera. So in terms of contributing to development, that seems very unclear. And in this case that they have launched against the government of Honduras, they are claiming that $11 billion is what their expected future profits might be in the future. And that's why they are claiming that under these extreme rules, investor rights that are included in the trade agreement, that they should be able to be compensated unless Honduras basically lets them do whatever they want according to the law that they previously invested under, that was put into place under the regime of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
And explain the role
and that
of
they
CAFTA.
Signed a
Can you explain the role of CAFTA in this? We have less than a minute to go. And the letter that Senator Warren and others have signed, what you're demanding of the Biden administration.
Yes. Yeah, so in CAFTA, there are these extreme investor rights that corporations can sue governments outside of the court system to demand billions or millions or billions in taxpayer compensation. And this is a very radical element of our past trading system, so much so that it is no longer considered to be a viable thing to include in trade agreements. The Biden administration is no longer seeking to include these extreme corporate rights in agreements, and yet it exists in CAFTA. And so this company is utilizing it. So Senator Warren and 30 members of Congress are calling on the Biden administration to weigh in on behalf of Honduras in this case so that they do not bankrupt this country, and also to seek to remove these extreme investor rights from CAFTA and other free trade agreements, given that now that there is bipartisan opposition to these very extreme rules that are exploited by corporations like Prospera.
Melinda St. Louis, want to thank you for being with us, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, and Vanessa Cardenas, leader of the Community Council of Crawfish Rock, the area directly impacted by the Prospera Sede on the island of Roatan in Honduras. Go to democracynow.org to hear this interview in Spanish. Oh, and a happy belated birthday to John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Ooh,
la, la, la. Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest Open Mic schedule.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.